Act of Isms is all about introducing you to new ways to engage. And we understand that every purchase you make is a vote for what you believe in.
So naturally, we gravitate towards mission-driven companies, which is why we've partnered with Wayakea. Wayakea is a brand built on three values that Act of Isms can confidently stand behind.
Healthy, sustainable, and ethical.
That's right. This volcanic water is naturally filtered through thousands of feet of lava rock, enhancing it with a unique blend of minerals, giving your body an alkaline pH.
Wayakea uses 100% post-recycled RPET bottles, low-emission shipping, and actively participates in regional reforestation, making them one of the first certified carbon-neutral beverages on the planet.
And best of all, for every liter of Wayakea you buy, Wayakea donates 1 week of clean drinking water to those in need.
So if you're going to buy bottled water, buy with Mother Earth in mind.
Go to store.wayakeasprings.com and use offer code ACTOFISMS to get a 10% discount on your first purchase or delivery subscription. When you support Wayakea, remember, you're also supporting this podcast. So thank you very much.
All right, now let's get into this episode.
Let's do it. Hi, I'm Tyler Batson. I'm a documentary filmmaker and peace advocate that spent over a decade on a mission to prove that peace is possible, even in the most unlikely spaces. And this is Act of Isms, a podcast about activists all over the world creating connection and compassion through conversation and action. And this is our final episode of the season. We couldn't have made it this far without you guys. Thank you so much for your support and your enthusiasm. During our conversations, we've achieved so much healing around issues of sexism, sexual trauma, LGBTQ inclusion, spiritual trauma, racism, body positivity. It's been incredible. And if you can believe it, pretty unexpected. Maria and I started this podcast out of pure curiosity of what radical compassion could create. So we're finishing off this season with a conversation on optimism. In the work that we do, optimism can sometimes be elusive, but always rewarding. So Maria and I sat down with Josh Mojica, somebody who knows a lot about optimism. He's a man that took it upon himself to cut through the noise of the Syrian refugee crisis to find optimism in one of the largest refugee camps in the world. It's a simple story about perseverance, passion, and the human connection that encompasses everything we're about. Connection, compassion, conversation, and action.
Yeah. Okay. So my name is Josh Mojica. I am a flight attendant and I live up in Seattle, Washington, and I am kind of an amateur photographer / humanitarian.
How did you jump from a flight attendant to kind of a humanitarian?
So being a flight attendant, I have a lot of flight benefits, obviously. So when I was traveling, I noticed that there's a real need for people like myself in my position to take more action to try and help people in need in other parts of the world. And I kind of figured since I have this great benefit, you know, and tool to just jump on a plane whenever I really feel like it, I could be more involved in world issues.
So what happened or what led you to start to explore this humanitarian component of your travel?
One specific situation that I got myself into was when I was traveling in 2015 to Myanmar for the first time, and a good friend of mine that I was with happened to get sick, and we ended up, long story short, in like a government hospital for like a day and a half. And in that time, we were treated so great being Americans in Myanmar. Medical care was super cheap. And I had to go back and forth, like in and out of the hospital, to kind of like buy different things like food, a pillow here and there, a fan, because the hospital was really hot. And the hospitals, just like the quality of the hospital was just so bad, so terrible. I mean, I saw like rats squirming around like the ICU units. I saw things in there that I probably shouldn't have seen. I mean, like people in cots just so close by. I mean, and then outside you had people just camped out waiting, sick, bleeding, horrible wounds, cuts, waiting outside of the hospital for someone essentially to die so they could go in.
Was this during a crisis or something? Or this is just normal operating procedure?
This
was
just normal operating day. Like, this was just a normal day in Myanmar up in Mandalay. And I saw this stuff and I was like, man, what is going on? Like, why are these people just out here literally like laying around like dogs in the street just waiting to go in the hospital? And we talked to a few of the nurses and staff who explained to us in as good English as they possibly could that that's just the way it is. Like, they don't have a lot of, you know, healthcare. They're not able to provide a lot of people, and they're so poor in that part of the country that they just can't they can't take on any more patients. You know, there's no more hospitals and things like that. So for me, seeing that was a big reality check. I'd always just traveled around like really cool spots and seen like really cool bridges and temples the whole week. And then all of a sudden I'm like in this government hospital. And even further than that, it was, you know, initially when we didn't have a bed to put my friend in, we were sitting there like, kind of, what do we do? Like, no one speaks any English. This family comes over with like food and a pillow and a chair with their dying son right in the next like bed over from us, and just started giving us stuff. And it was like one of the kindest, nicest things that I'd ever seen. Just after that was kind of like, okay, I need to start, I don't know, looking more into this. Like, this is reality and this is their lives every single day. And it's not something that I was used to. So I started, you know, researching refugees and the plight in Syria and all these different things that were happening around the world, you know, wars in Africa, things like that, that I could see myself getting involved in. But I was also kind of like scared because I was like, how do I get involved with things like this? This is kind of out of my comfort zone. Where do I go?
Talk to me a little bit about that fear, because a lot of the fear that people have is based on what they're seeing on the news. How, first of all, did you get beyond the fear before you left, and how did you respond to that fear once you arrived?
Okay, so I was very, very scared. The first time I ever actually went on my first humanitarian trip, I was...
You were alone, presumably?
I was alone. I had reached out to a few groups and a friend who had recently been over there working with a team of photographers, kind of like documenting the Syrian refugee crisis, but over in Greece. And I had saw some of his posts and I was like, you know, Tyson, dude, how are you doing this right now? Like, what's going on? And he's like, oh, I'm with some photographers and it's really easy. You should come over and, you know.
It's really easy.
Yeah, he was just kind of like, you know, there, like doing this kind of like, you know, assignment thing. And getting over that initial fear just meant hopping on a plane and going. So that's what I did. I went with the fear. It wasn't like I put the fear aside and went. It was definitely like I was scared the whole way there.
Were people afraid for you when you told them that you were leaving?
I didn't really tell a lot of people that I was leaving to go help refugees. A lot of the media portrayed refugees as like very dangerous, very erratic, you know, a lot of rioting, that kind of stuff, which again is only a fraction, not even a fraction of what you actually get when you're there working with them. It was a way better experience than I could have ever imagined.
So what happened?
Essentially, the week I'd gotten there, a week or two prior, they had just like doubled in size. So the camp went from about 8,000 people to a good like 16-ish overnight. They gave me an option to either go with them to Lesvos or to stay in Idomeni. And so I decided to stay in Idomeni and work with a couple other groups who are more like grassroots type organizations who were just like cooking and building tents around the camps, which I preferred. So I decided to stay and do that. I kind of became like a cook for 3 weeks, which was really out of my comfort zone, but I loved it. It was really fun.
So you're essentially talking about going to a refugee camp, one of the largest in the world at the time, worldwide crisis, and basically showing up almost like summer camp or something. Like, yeah, you're one person helping out wherever you can, and you end up cooking, building tents. Is this with any, you know, translator or anything, or you're just going through this with what you got?
Kind of a little bit of both. At the time, like a few days in, I hadn't talked to anybody who was speaking any English, so I just looked for white people. Mm-hmm. I found some Dutch girls who kind of pointed me in the right direction, who were pretty cool. Had a funny experience where one of the second nights I was there, I was looking for this bus who was apparently cooking for, you know, these refugees, but I didn't know where exactly it was. So when I found it, finally, there was like two lines, like queues, like one for men and one for women for food, like for meals. And there were these girls kind of like doing security on the line. And so I asked them like, hey, is this like the food bus? Like, can I get involved? And they were just kind of like, like really flustered. Like, we're doing a lot of stuff, but if you want to stand security, you can, you know. And the reason why they have security is because a lot of refugees tend to cut and skip, you know, and try and like get extra meals and bring back like more food to their tents and stuff. And so to be fair, you have to really like man some of these queues. And so I started doing that. I just held my hands up and started like with my backpack on, just like, mm-hmm, all right, I'm just gonna plant right here and just like do this. And it was really funny. This guy who I actually became really good friends with, his name is Gafour. He comes out in a cooking apron and he just like looks at me and starts like telling me to get back in line, like in Arabic. And I'm like, wait, what? And he's like, wait, what? And I'm like, yeah, what? I'm not a refugee. What the heck? He's like, oh, you speak English. And he's British, you know? And I'm like, yeah, what the heck do you think of? I'm not a refugee. And he was like, you just look like a refugee, you know? I don't know. And you look pretty, I mean, refugee. Like, I thought you were a refugee. And I was like, dang it, I must look like crap. So anyway, yeah, he thought I was a refugee. Funny story, haha. And he's like, well, do you want a job? And I'm like, yeah, I would love a job. I'm so lost here. Like, what do I do? This place is so huge. And he's like, come with me. And then he takes me on to his bus, which is essentially a big gutted out charter bus with all of this, like, with like four stoves and a bunch of pots and like all this stuff, essentially a huge mobile kitchen. And it was like, hey, like, this is Josh, you know, everybody be nice to him, show him the ropes, blah blah blah. I met a few Pakistani guys, some Syrian people, a few like Dutch girls, and this one like British lady, and they just kind of took me in, and they kind of became my family for those like 3 weeks I was there. It was great.
You weren't essentially living their experience with them, were you?
I guess in a way. I mean, so I lived in camp. You know, after a few, every now and again, like some nights I would just stay in the camps and sleep with families in their tents and wake up with them and shower with them and use the little sinks on the side of the road or whatever and just like bathe or not bathe, whatever. Wake up super early, come back, prep the truck and the bus and just like get to work. And I felt like I was living it with them in the sense that, like, you know, sometimes police were really mean for no reason. Sometimes locals didn't understand because of, you know, the language barrier. You know, I had to kind of almost like defend them sometimes. We'd go out and we'd eat and people would hear that we were helping refugees and they wouldn't want to serve us or they'd be like rude. And so
this is local Greeks?
Yeah, sometimes you got that, you know, and other times I went out there, we had people, when I'd hand out food to refugees in the street, locals would chuck tomatoes at us from their window. Like, just like stuff like that. Yeah, it was crazy because, you know, they just wanted them to leave. You know, to them, they're like roaches. They're just like, go away.
So in America, a lot of people are afraid of refugees. They're afraid that our resources will be taken from us. And it sounds like that's what you experienced in Greece as well. These people feel like these refugees are infringing on our land, our space, our resources. How do you address that argument or that sentiment?
It's just understanding where they're coming from. You know, bombs drop on everybody. If bombs drop on us, you know, we would hope that Canada or Mexico or anybody would come to our aid. Essentially, we're all part of one human family. So at the end of the day, they're kind of our brothers and sisters on this earth. So we really should just like help each other out as best we can, you know?
I love that.
Me too.
What were some of the opportunities that you found to connect with these refugees on just a human to human level?
I just made friends with them. I just was like, let's go for a walk. Let's go play soccer on the side of the field, you know, and invite people over. And
you had fun.
Well, I mean, it was fun to a point. I mean, there was a lot of obviously like serious, you know, crazy things that I saw and did. But I had like friends. I had like Syrian, Pakistani refugee friends. I didn't want to leave them. We got so tight because of this experience that I just kept like dropping my trips, like all my work trips, because I was just like, no, I need to stay longer. I need to stay longer. And they had kind of taken me under their wing and into their homes, which essentially were tents at the time, you know, and fed me and introduced me to their babies and their kids. And I just loved it.
What's going through your head at this time while you're making all these close friendships and relationships with people? Did it cross your mind at all, the stories that were being shared on the news back home?
Yeah, it actually was interesting because I kept in touch with my dad, who's a news fanatic, like all of our parents, is like always in the background all the time. And so my dad would tell me, like, you know, things like there was riots in Idomeni. I was just like, nah, man, like, there was a riot last week, but you've put people in a situation where they're left to, you know, sit around and wait and starve and potentially like slowly die. They're going to get testy. I mean, you have to put that context into the situation, you know, like they're not sitting there just like rioting all willy-nilly. They're desperate. And so they wanted attention. They wanted someone to hear their voices. And so that's the only way sometimes to get the attention is to kind of do extreme things. But at the exact same time, I was cooking in the back of the camp, like having a great time and playing soccer with a bunch of kids and, you know, hanging out at the nursery. And we were building playgrounds essentially for all the little kids in the area. And so like what the news tends to hone in on, like they tend to not really focus on all the good that's happening. Like, we were building volleyball nets and playing volleyball and teaching kids how to like play games that no one had ever heard of, you know, and these were all
feeding them
and feeding them, yeah. You know, and I was learning how to cook like traditional, like, you know, Arabic food. And, you know, we had, you know, farmers donating like goats and lamb, I mean, like, and all of this stuff to us just to help us out. And so it was a really cool experience to like see all the good that was happening there, despite what the media tended to focus on.
Do you have any theories on why the media chooses to focus on the negative?
Ratings? I don't know. They're just the kind of things people want to hear, I guess, which is a little bit sad because as a society, we tend to focus so much on the negative. It makes us kind of scared of the world, which is why people were so worried about me going, I think, initially, even myself. But then when I got there and hearing their stories, you know, some of these people were like really, you know, influential, cool, amazing, talented, successful people in Syria. You know, one of the first men I actually met, he was an investment banker or something, and he got this job overseas working in the UK. Then he got hired and picked up by an American company in San Francisco. So he moved his whole family over to San Francisco for like 5 or 6 years. But then his mother got sick back in Syria. So he moved back with his family to take care of her. And then the crisis happened. You know, the war began and it just got worse and worse. And so this man who's making like 6 figures over in San Francisco suddenly has nothing and is living in a camp. Like, that was wild to me. But put him in a camp, suddenly like that context, that environment makes him like a bad person to people.
It's interesting how the label refugee can just erase any other identifier from a person. We make all these assumptions about what that means and what this person is like and put them all in a category together when really, like you're saying, these people represent an entire society. They're all different kinds of people. They're just sharing a common experience.
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, they want to be, you know, known for their talents and their occupations and being a strong mother, being a good father. All these things that we as Americans and anyone just want to be identified as, you know, good, solid people.
Have you ever experienced any kind of discrimination of your own in your own life?
Yeah, for a lot of things, you know. I grew up in the South for middle school, high school, and being, you know, a little bit darker was always an issue. I've also experienced, you know, like as a gay man, you know, I've had it like growing up, you get bullied, you know, and like people like talk crap about you and stuff. I take it all with a grain of salt, really. I'm just Josh. That's all I can be. As far as refugees, though, a lot
I love how you just gloss over that. You're a gay man working with Muslim refugees.
Well, as
how does that work out?
It's actually okay. I mean, it never really was an issue. It never really came up. Refugees in that situation, for the most part, are just so loving and just so happy to be taken care of and to be looked at.
How has this, if at all, affected your American relationships or your friendships or family relationships here?
They're just happy that someone's able to do it. And I think it's having that experience and being able to talk to my friends about it who aren't really that up on news or, you know, keep up with that kind of stuff, which has been like the biggest thing for me, is like, I guess having more pride as an American, wanting to share my experiences with other Americans and helping them to understand that Muslims and refugees are actually great people. And they're not bad, awful terrorists. They're actually just like us. And if we see them on the street or if we see them in our communities, we should be like so much more open to getting to know them and volunteering and getting more involved locally, because it's really an easy thing to do.
One thing that sticks out that I was not necessarily anticipating you saying is that humanitarian aid work is fun. I mean, you're laughing, but that's what you said. The way that you describe it is as if it's fun.
Well,
and the, I mean,
the sounds fun the way you describe it.
It sounds fun. I believe you. I believe you. But if it's so fun, why aren't more people doing it?
Again, I think it's just a fear thing. You know, I'm a pretty social person. I really enjoy talking to people and meeting new people. That part of it isn't really hard for me. I think the hard part is hearing the stories and getting so involved. There were some stories that when I think about and they come to mind as I talk about this, like, are really hard to like think about. You know, I just met recently a woman whose husband died right in front of her, trying to escape a platoon of like, I don't know, a dozen people shooting at them, you know, over in Myanmar, crossing into Bangladesh. And She lost her husband.
This is the Rohingya?
This is the Rohingya, yeah. I haven't really touched on that. There's another group that's kind of persecuted, and so I went to go work with some of those people and hear their stories.
So you just hopped on a plane again and decided to make it all happen, find something that you can do and help out.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you at all realize the... I mean, we're talking about this so casually right now, but that's not a normal response, unfortunately. How do we normalize that for people? Because the idea is to get more people involved, right?
Again, I don't know if you can normalize like, hey, I'm just going to hop on a plane on a Wednesday and go help some people on the side of the world. You know, I guess when I hear it out loud, it's weird. It's kind of odd. You know, I can't tell you what my motivation stems from. You know, I've been through a lot in my life that's made me just want to be more open-minded and more helpful towards people who felt displaced or unwanted. I myself have felt that way, especially the last few years. I guess I just wanted to vent some of that. For me, it is fun getting to know these people. It's fun walking around camps and high-fiving these kids who don't even know how to high-five. They've never seen a high-five. It blows my mind. Like, people, they were like looking at my hand like, what do you do with that? I'm like, just hit it. Just hit my hand, man. It's awesome. It's really fun. And teaching kids how to like play fun games. And I got to teach once for like 3 solid weeks English to like 4 different, you know, age groups. That was hard. That was so hard. But it taught me a lot. I was sick the entire time, but they were like my babies. Like, I loved them so much. I wanted to stay there and just put them all in my arms and tell them it's gonna be okay. And we would just recite funny things, you know, like I'd make them repeat over and over, open the border, you know, and we would learn to write, you know, help us open the border, you know.
Oh, my God, I would cry.
And we would. but those things were like so, so awesome. I just don't think you can be like uber serious about everything. I think people in America get so like caught up in like, well, how do I do that? It's so foreign. What do I do? And I'm like, it's really simple. If you see a lady, you know, wearing a, I can't even think of the word right now.
A hijab.
Yes. That word. If you see someone, I mean, just smile at them, say hi, you know, ask how their day's going, you know, like they're a little skittish because they are in a new country, a new place. I mean, imagine what that would feel like, to be like forced to go somewhere new. It's just one of those things where if we're just more aware of people like that, and they're all around, it's really not hard. And I think that's how we normalize it, is just stop like judging people and just start saying hi. Just be cool. Like they're just like us. They literally are just like us.
Are you optimistic that the crisis can be resolved?
Yeah, but it's going to take time. It's going to be a long, long, long process. I mean, the reality is they have to leave. They can't stay. So let's just not moan and be sad about it. Like, let's just get past it and help them find their place in the world and move forward. I mean, we can stay stuck in this like depressed, like, oh, it's so terrible mode forever. But the reality is like they really just need to like get up and get their lives moving again. And so if we can make that easier for these people, then I think, yeah, it makes me optimistic. Let's just change the conversation. Let's just make it a thing where we're just going to help them. And we're just going to like take it day by day. And I think that comes with helping our children, our children's children become more aware, being less judgy, and just like focusing on how we can make our communities better in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the common way that people treat them is lower than vagrants, lower than homeless people. Mm-hmm. And the way you're describing them is as people who can actually contribute to societies, who have the capacity to even improve the society.
Yeah, 100%.
I think also what you're describing is this cultural state of resistance, which we're experiencing in so many areas. You know, making things easier for the refugees would also make things easier for the people who have to assimilate them into their communities. The longer we resist, the more uncomfortable it is for everyone.
Absolutely. I completely agree. It is one of those things where if we just keep fighting this idea of letting people come in, it just makes it more tense. Because where are they going to go?
Right.
They're in limbo.
And I think that's a barrier to a lot of people getting involved, because they're like, well, what is my one thing going to do in the giant scheme of this global problem?
People are pessimistic.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, I struggle with that a lot, especially last year and with everything I'm trying to do to help refugees. And to be honest, that feeling won't go away. It doesn't go away, but there are ways to kind of subside it a little bit, right? This is like a little moment I have with these people, and it's a great opportunity to like learn about myself and about them. And I'm gonna go feed who I can. And that's all I can do. Literally, it's all I can do. You know, I can't change it overnight. I just try to focus on the positive.
Has it made you happier?
Definitely. Definitely. Happiness for me can be a little complicated sometimes, but the feelings I've had and the experiences I've had with people, the openness I feel towards others now, I'm happier when I'm doing good things. I just love being attached to like something bigger than myself. It makes me feel connected.
Is optimism a survival mechanism?
Yeah. I mean, you've got to stay positive. I always tell my refugees, keep your smile. I'm very much a realist. You know, I tell them, yeah, your situation sucks sometimes. Some of my good friends, I say, yeah, it sucks. But I think of this as like a moment in time where like, you're going to like look past this or look back on this in like 30, 40 years and think, I went through something hard and I got through it and now I'm fine. And I have beautiful Danish kids, you know, or something. And they're awesome. And I keep telling them, yeah, you're going to have that one day. You're going to have that. You know, it's just a matter of keeping your smile.
What do you say to people who are stuck in the conversation, stuck in the like back and forth on Facebook? What do you do once you to get past the point of conversation?
It's just throwing yourself into the unknown. Sometimes you have to do that to understand something. You know what I mean? Like, and what is life if not throwing yourself into the unknown all the time?
All of it is unknown.
All of it, right? So, I mean, that's all we do on a daily basis. This shouldn't be any different, you know? Humanitarian aid should be something we look forward to. And at the end of the day, you're not going to regret trying to do something good. So,
amen. Can we high five on that?
I guess boom.
I'd like to thank Josh Mojica for opening our eyes to the people behind the crisis in Syria. I consider this to be an especially unique opportunity to really understand the crisis in a way that doesn't dehumanize the Syrian people into just another number, but rather acknowledges them as human beings that deserve our compassion and understanding. Be sure to follow Josh's project on Instagram at The Struggle Is Real. That's THISTRUGGLEISREAL. And on behalf of myself and Maria, thank you to everyone who appeared on this season of Act of Isms. James Joyce III, Amelia Richardson, Kathleen Schaefer, Pat Harris, Derek Marshall, Saro Sandalgian, Aleko Bryce, everyone we spoke to at March for Our Lives LA, Adam McLean, Jonathan Randall Grant, Michael Vasquez, Alicia Crosby, Tim Wolf, and everyone who helped this dream become a reality. Be sure to follow, like, and subscribe to Activisms at Activisms on iTunes, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can reach Tyler on Instagram at DigitalStoryTyler and Maria at Maria.being. And you can always reach us at Activisms.com. We love you guys. Thank you so much. This was truly a team effort and made with so much love. So thank you once again. Till next time, take care.